Good morning. Did you all get your tickets? If not, well, don't look back in anger. Better to just roll with it. I'm referring, of course, to one of the biggest showbiz stories in years this week. In news that will delight bucket hat sellers globally, even the Mayor of Manchester got involved.
Well, it's the news we've all been waiting for. It promises to be a massive day for Manchester. But you know what? It would be the most Noel and Liam thing ever if one of them woke up this morning and decided they'd had a change of heart. I really, really hope that doesn't happen.
I think I love that. Imagine that. No, I'm not having it. No. Do you know what's going to make them have it? 60 million each.
And aside from the lads' bank managers, someone else who was very happy with the reunion is one Paul McKeever, who also spoke to Shea Byrne.
I played a part of Noel Gallagher in an Oasis tribute band. I'll live forever.
Yeah, and you will live forever on the money you're going to make now in the next year.
Don't tell too many people that.
No. You must have been waiting on tenterhooks to see if they were coming to Ireland.
Oh, no, they would have had to. The only thing is that two nights in Croke Park will not be enough. I wouldn't rule out other festivals, maybe Slam, maybe something else. They're probably just testing the water with it. But they've left plenty of space in between their dates, I've noticed. So I've no doubt that extra nights will be added. I mean, if Garth Brooks can do 5, Oasis will do 6.
Garth Brooks could have done more.
Well, you're obviously a Garth Brooks fan, so I'll let you away with that.
Even Dave Fanning was happy Oasis were coming back. Or was he? It's actually quite hard to tell.
And they do have the swagger, even though when you see them live, they don't exactly use the stage. They're just there doing it. I mean, he's slightly kind of crooked with his hands behind his back with the parka jacket, just kind of wailing into the thing. And he's a much better singer than Noel, so Noel needs him. I mean, yeah, it's all good fun. I'm delighted they're coming back, you know. Do I think they're one of the greatest bands ever? No. Do I like them? Yeah.
Over in Charlestown, a county desperate for anyone with any kind of Mayo link to get to Croke Park, local publican John Finnan told Clare Byrne how proud a day it was for the parish.
I'm delighted for them, and not only Charlestown was delighted for them as well, like sort of thing, you know.
I'm sure. And their grandmother would frequent your premises, is that right?
When the Lord of Mercy, she's dead, no. She did her shopping there every Friday, the patron day, and that's how the connection was here, the grandmother, like, and the mother, and her sister, her the grandmother, and her daughter, Brady, that came in here shopping every Friday. Mm. And
it was, when they would come into you, would they play a song or sing or just have
Liam sang here one night. It was a session of music here one night, and he was in the bar, and he said, he asked his dad, could he borrow his guitar, and he sang a song with us. So he didn't sing them with traditional music, he sang some song. I think he did a recording of a song here, if I'm not mistaken, like, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. During the summers going back over the years, would they be regulars around the town?
They would be regulars, but they wouldn't be regulars in my pub all the time. They'd be in different pubs, like, they'd go to the type of pub I have. I have a shop in the front and a pub in the back. It's not everybody's cup of tea, you see. Mm-hmm. Sort of.
Yeah.
But they come in, when James Casey saw the pub, they come in here a lot then, and the most emotional day I had was the day of the granny's funeral. That was the most emotional day we had, like, you know. That 2 glasses of Guinness after the funeral here with a customer in the shop, and he bought them a drink. He drank with their grandmother, like, of a Friday here, the patient, and he bought them a drink. And it was really emotional. They told him along the bear and black suits and sunglasses and the lot, like, and they were very nice lads to me, though. They were very good to me, like, you know. Now, the music, you know, and like the pub, they said they like the pub. I know whether they do or not, I don't know.
But I'm sure they do.
They come into it, you know, yeah, they come into it, like, and then. But, like, it's good to see them back together again, and we, with the help of God, they stay together, like, you know. I wouldn't know much about them out from the music situation now. I wouldn't know much about them, you know.
And if you did manage to get tickets this morning and are now planning getting a bed in Dublin next August, well, be prepared to pay. As Evelyn O'Rourke told Rachel English on the News at One.
Hotel prices in Dublin are high at the best of times, but I think there's some evidence that the prices for the 16th and 17th of August next year are going to be especially steep.
Gosh, wasn't it extraordinary? I mean, first thing this morning, we were hearing the news and immediately checking out well-known travel sites, and you could just see it. I think at one point at about 9:30, there were 15 places available for me when I looked, ranging in price. When I checked in again at midday, that had really shrunk. And on the top of one of the sites I was looking at, it had the rather daunting line of 98% of our usual properties on the site are unavailable for those dates. So I'm really impressed at the confidence of people who are booking hotel rooms before they get the tickets. But the prices are going to be eye-watering. So there's going to be a lot of working out lifts and buses and all that kind of thing. But for those who are lucky enough maybe to get their hands on a ticket, you know, the best of luck to them. And there'll be lots of people bitter, I'm sure, who won't get tickets, who won't be feeling too sorry for them.
Now, Where did I put that phone number for my favourite Dublin cousin? It wasn't just Oasis having a musical impact in the 1990s. On Monday's Lifeline, Willie McGill rang Joe about a very pressing issue. Since 1995, Willie has been humming a song he heard on 2FM, and he can't figure out the name. So what does the song sound like? Sing to Joe, Willie. Sing to Joe.
La la da 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 la da 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 la da 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 la la da 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 la da 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 la da 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 da. That's like that. That's the air.
Yeah.
We tried to put the lyrics, but unsuccessfully. You know.
Well. Was there any words in it?
Oh, there was words, Joe.
But no, but are any, remember, any key words, a phrase? Help me here, Willie, help me.
Believe it or not, Joe, I can't.
Okay, well, that's fair enough.
I tried a lot of...
I know, okay.
...record stores.
William.
Yeah.
Concentrate. I know you are concentrate. Is there any phrase in it? Was the word love in it? God, that doesn't narrow anything down, does it? Was there any phrase in it that...
Just got to let you know, I thought was at the end of it. I just got to let you know.
You had a good few chords there. Give me the air again, would you mind?
La la da 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 la da da da. I just got to let you know.
Stay with us, Willie. Does anyone know the song? Help! Help! Help!
Talk to
help,
Joe on help. 0818 715 815.
Joe opened it to the live line to see could they figure out Willie's 30-year-old musical earworm. Could it be this one?
Don't ever want to lose this feeling. No.
Oh, okay. Another one says, is it Celine Dion? The wonderful Celine Dion. Because there is a line in that, you saw the best there was in me. You gave
me I know, yeah.
Yeah, you'd remember.
No, it was definitely a male artist.
Okay.
Ooh, we could be here a while.
Is it Coda line? Because they have a line, because you brought the best out in me.
Oh,
ah, great song.
Great song, but they wouldn't have been around then, I think, Joe, would they?
No.
No.
Is it, hang on, is it Boyzone? Because they were away, they were around 1995. Boyzone, and apparently in the Keys to My Life there's some familiar lyrics.
Wouldn't it,
Rain on the window covers the trees.
It's definitely not that, will you? We go.
Wouldn't be, Joe, no.
Okay.
I know they were around that in 95, okay. Alright.
Let Loose, Best in Me, as you'd have suggested. Let Loose.
That's it, Joe.
What?
That's it, Joe.
So what?
Hey, Joe.
Are you sure that's it?
That's it, Joe.
Who suggested that? Brilliant. Brilliant.
Good man, Joe Duffy.
Well, it's called Best of Me.
La, 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 da, 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 la, la, la.
Oh, yeah. Come in again, will you? Come on, join in.
Yeah.
It's lovely, yeah.
La 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 la
la la la live line strikes again. Meanwhile, over on 2FM Breakfast, the Clock Blockers competition entrant Anya could really have done with the money.
All right, let's see who we have on the line. Anya, are you there?
I am indeed. Good morning.
How are you today, Anya?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Good, not too bad. What are you doing with yourself today?
I'm kind of trying to get myself in gear. I'm moving to Australia next week. So
no,
kind of
Anya! No! This is not allowed. I won't allow this. What do you do? What are you heading over to do?
I'm a junior doctor, so it'll work as a doctor for my life. I'll come back.
She promised you'll come back.
I promise.
Anya is one of thousands moving to Australia each year, as new data this week showed a huge spike in numbers heading down under. Well-known political reporter Aisling Maloney spoke to Cormac on Drive Time about this new data and how she herself has added to statistics.
The highest level of immigration to Australia since 2013, according to the CSO. Journalist Aisling Maloney is on the line now and is moving to Australia in 2 weeks, Aisling.
Yes, indeed. The countdown's on, Cormac.
You're adding to the list.
I'm moving in 2 weeks. I decided to make the jump myself. I'm 27, so I'm kind of that key demographic potentially that is moving. I think it's quite hard to put this down to one thing. I'm going for the quality of life and the lifestyle in terms of the weather. I think we all can see in the weather in the summer that we've had this year that it does really affect your life. So that's something that's definitely a reason I'm going.
What do you mean when you say quality of life? Isn't there a great quality of life here?
There is, in fairness, and I think there is a cohort of people who will talk about moving because I suppose everything's bad and everything's getting in on them in terms of the cost of living potentially, the housing crisis, which is definitely an element of some of it. The idea this social contract has maybe broken down for a lot of people. You go to college, you work hard to get a good university degree, you come out, you get a good job. And in fairness, at the moment in the Irish economy, everyone who wants a job nearly has one. And there's element of that of people saying, well, I can't afford a house. I'll never be able to afford a house maybe in my 20s and maybe even my early 30s. So I'm going to go abroad. I'm going to go off on an adventure.
Before coming on air, Aisling did a straw poll on her Instagram account. And given that many of her friends are leaving Ireland as well, she asked them why.
Cost of living was one thing. You know, the weather is another. You get three times the salary in Australia. One person was telling me it's a better functioning country, better opportunities, but also a better lifestyle. It's not all about money. It's the weather. And also employers expect too much of people in Ireland, they say, and that people can enjoy their life a bit more over there. Healthcare, I know a lot of doctors who went over in the last couple of years after graduating. And like when they go into the hospitals, they get great opportunities because they're huge hospitals. So they learn loads, but then they also don't have to work crazy hours. Like it would be unheard of to work over 40 hours in many hospitals as a junior doctor. And so that's a thing that they don't get when they get in the health service here. Yeah. They find that they're working very long hours. And we saw that recently with the Medical Council survey saying that I think the majority of young junior doctors are working much longer than the standard work week. Mm. So there's that. And also the weather makes up for a lot. I mean, you've got absolutely fantastic weather most of the year. In some places, in particular like Perth, they have great weather. I mean, my sister lives in Perth and she said they've barely gotten a winter this year. They haven't taken out the winter clothes at all and it's never below 20 degrees. And I mean, that's been our summer.
Oh, so God, that sounds awful. That sounds awful.
Just don't forget your sunnies, Aisling. Now, immigration featured on This Week, but for very different reasons. As a small but increasingly vocal far right continues to use social media to spread division and mistrust. The programme featured an online video posted by Justin Barrett, who is a failed candidate in the recent European elections. It was made at Mail na Blá, and Barrett was accompanied by a group of masked men.
We will protect ourselves too from the overreaching arm of so-called law and order. We will act within the law. We will act as peaceful as we can. We will also be ready to protect ourselves and defend ourselves with as much violence as is necessary.
Interviewed on the programme was Brian Fanning, Professor of Migration and Social Policy in UCD, who commented on the wider use of immigration to serve some political agendas.
Justin Barrett is a very eccentric and very marginal figure, I would imagine, within the far right. Historically, he was part of another political group. He fell out with them. And basically, it's hard to see who he's speaking for except for himself. Well, we've sort of seen a trajectory whereby basically some relatively small number of well enough known far right activists kept serially turning up at places and claiming various protests for their cause. And then we've seen incidents such as the Dublin riot. We've seen incidents such as what's been happening in Coolock. We've seen similar events taking place in Northern Ireland involving, to some extent, some people from the south. There is a sort of a sense out there, perhaps among some people, there's a sort of an amplified sense of shifting norms and perhaps a feel that they can do this kind of thing, or that they're licensed to express more vehemently or talk in more extremist terms about the kinds of things they're doing. That said, I do think that these people are increasingly detached from any form of serious debate. Mm. So the far right basically don't seem to have muscled into mainstream Irish politics to any great success in the recent locals, although we do have a few people who are single issue far right persons who are elected out of over 900 candidates. And at the same time, we do sort of see basically quite a lot of extremism out there at the same time. And an increased recognition across the board, I think, that what we have with the far right is a law and order and a security problem and that needs to be treated as such, whilst a lot of the real genuine concerns that people have and questions people are asking in various communities need to be addressed perhaps in other ways, particularly through social policy.
And that was Professor Brian Fanning speaking with Justin McCarthy on This Week. Back shortly. Welcome back. Brian O'Connell here, sitting in for Sinead. On Saturday, Patsy McGarry, long-time religious affairs correspondent with the Irish Times, was on with Brendan to talk about his new memoir. One episode in his book deals with former Bishop Eamon Casey and a contact a woman made with Patsy McGarry, alleging she had a relationship with Casey. Here Patsy takes up the story in the mid-noughties, when Eamon Casey had been based in the south of England.
He was there for about 5 years before eventually he was allowed back to Ireland in 2006, and he was in Shanaglish in East Galway, a remote rural parish where he was away from media attention, and he settled down in there quite easily and became very friendly with the local people, but wasn't allowed, say, Mass, wasn't allowed public ministry. Now, at that stage, we were all aware of abuser priests, of bishops who'd covered up, who are allowed, say, Mass. And I and others thought this was outrageous, that he was being, it was revenge, if you like, for him. He was a bishop, fine, rather than a priest. I wrote a couple of pieces in the paper highlighting this as just abuse of the church of this man, if you like.
So then you believe that this woman, this other woman who had the affair with Casey, was sent to you by the bishops, essentially.
Yeah, I don't know if she's necessarily the sort of person you could send.
Yeah.
She was a practicing Catholic. I knew her. Through mutual friends, we had met many times beforehand, and she asked to meet me confidentially. So she set up a meeting in the Westbury Hotel about 2008, and I met her and we had coffee and tea, and she told me the story that she'd went to London from Ireland after her convent education, etc., became involved with Shelter, of which Casey was co-founder and president at the time. This was an agency set up to house Irish immigrants initially, and then it extended to housing homeless people. She and he had an affair, and it continued there into the late 60s period until he was appointed Bishop of Kerry. And he came back to Ireland, and though they resumed contact, because she was in Ireland back that time too, the affair was not resumed. And I was intrigued as to why this woman, who I knew, wanted to tell me this, and why she was also binding me to confidence on the matter, telling me this as a journalist and in the particular role I had. And I asked her, it just dawned on me, I said, does the Bishop of Galway know you're coming to talk to me? And she said, yes. And the Bishop of Galway at the time was Martin Drennan. So then the penny dropped, and basically the signal being sent to me was, as has transpired since, they didn't know what else was going to emerge about Casey.
Much worse was to emerge about Eamon Casey, including multiple allegations of sexual abuse. Based on this, Brendan asked Patsy if later allegations have caused him to reassess his view of Casey.
All I'll say, Brendan, is this is a very difficult situation. The dice is loaded against people making allegations, when it comes to rape or whatever, because immediately the right of the accused to be innocent until proven guilty kicks in. And often the consequences for the person making the allegation is difficult in the legal system. All I do know is this, that, and I reported on it at the time in 2006, that Patricia made the allegation in 2005. First of all, November 2005, she was in the UK. He was in the UK. The guards investigated from the beginning of 2006. They met Patricia in the UK, interviewed her. It continued throughout 2006. And finally, they investigated. They met Casey himself, interrogated him for 6 hours, And within weeks, he was told there were no charges. There were 13 charges.
Yeah, he was astonished himself how quickly
he said that to me.
And the Garda Commissioner has now said that he wants to look at that because he says there's a query over the nature and efficiency and effectiveness of that investigation. He wants to be sure of the standard of the original investigation.
And I welcome
that. Now, there were alleged events in every diocese where Casey worked. The Diocese of Limerick settled a High Court case with its fifth accuser, I think without admission, but for more than €100,000. There was another settlement paid by...
That was 2 years after he died. I'm just sticking to the facts. All I'm saying is this. The allegations are there. There is no evidence yet.
Allegations, Patsy. I mean, settlements have been made. Are you telling me that... We were talking earlier about a church that wouldn't accept the abuse that did happen. Are you suggesting they now accepted and settled for abuse that maybe didn't happen? It would seem unlikely.
Without dealing with this specific case, Brendan, the church the bishops have not changed their tack. It's still about protecting the institution. And so now they daren't go into a court to challenge an abuse survivor because they know what would happen.
The current Bishop of Limerick, Dr. Brendan Leahy, who has access to documents relating to complaints made in the diocese, he has said, "They deserve our respect, belief and support." He says, "I have no reason to disbelieve any of the allegations made." So even the church, with their appalling record in this, believe those women.
No, they don't disbelieve them. Let's not forget, Brendan, that these...
They deserve our respect, belief and support.
Yes, I agree. But he said he didn't disbelieve. I mean, I've been on the side of abuse survivors all my career as a religious affairs correspondent,
I'm so surprised at your attitude to Casey.
Well, the point about it, Brendan, simply is that there are allegations, and allegations are not evidence, and the only case that has been tested didn't go to a judge.
Are you applying this burden of proof to all the child abuse that occurred in the church down the years? Because there was often very little proof, but what we have is we have four people from four different places independently accusing this man of something.
Yeah, none of them have gone to court.
The book is called Well, Holy God. It's published by Merriam Press. Patsy McGarry, thank you so much.
Now, that's what you call a robust exchange. On a different topic, someone else not afraid to express an opinion was Oliver Callan when it came to teeing up his guest, well-known TV architect Hugh Wallace.
We have a great show for you now today. Design legend Mr. Hugh Wallace is in the building and he will be on with us. It'll be of special interest, by the way, to those of you lucky enough to live in period properties, in the fancy homes, as you might call them, old creaky buildings filled with charm and elegance and drafts and damp and all of that things that you strange people seem to adore in those old buildings. He's going to be doing another series of Great House Revivals. So he wants you and he wants your project, I suppose. So we'll chat about other things as well, of course. And actually, just looking around, I was thinking the Radio Centre, the RT Radio Centre, could do with a Great House Revival, couldn't it? But no amount of sandblasting could ever wash away our shame, let's face it. That's how we feel every morning. 51551 is the text.
It suddenly feels very chilly in the building here. Once his guest arrived, though, Oliver turned on the charm.
You look extraordinarily well. 67, I think it says.
Yeah, 67. Yeah. The best bit is getting the bus pass.
68.
I love the bus pass.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, gosh. I adore public transport. I've been converted.
You make it sound like you're kind of riding public transport as a little novelty for yourself.
It is. I get on the top of the bus and I love it. And I look out the window and I think, isn't this wonderful? And you can see so much. You can see into people's windows from the top
That's
of the bus.
Really good. I can see why you would enjoy
the top
of the bus.
I love it. You can see, you know, have they got the master bedroom correct? You know, I just love it.
Did you come here by bus? Martin is your husband and partner of 38 years.
Yeah. Of bliss, as you can imagine. You know, those little ups and downs.
Is it a period property, your house?
It's an old two-story 1910 cottage, workers' cottage.
Hugh also had thoughts on the number of derelict and empty properties dotted around the Irish landscape.
So in the census, there was 160,000 vacant properties. So if you have a building where there's a shop in it and nothing over it, it's not vacant. So you can add on probably another 60,000.
You're dead right, yeah.
You can add on another 60,000.
Come here, the next season, Great House Revival, it's going to, you start filming it now in the autumn-winter, is it?
Yeah.
So you're looking for people.
Looking for brave souls who are doing up amazing buildings, big, small, anything in between, cow sheds, love it all. Preferably before 1915.
Yeah, it's just they've taken on such a job, and I'm nervous for them.
Yeah.
And sometimes we don't get the end point, obviously, because you've got limited filming time.
Correct.
I go, you come back to those other people sometime and tell us.
Well, we'd love to.
Are they frozen
to death?
We'd love
to. Would you put in a good word to them upstairs, if you wouldn't mind?
Because you are like a psychologist in many ways through that show, aren't you? You come in and you encourage them, but you also, you're looking to the camera at, oh God, look, don't look up, look at the walls, they're the endless problems.
The best was Sully and Mary Clare down in Cork, who bought the house. And I said, did you get an engineer in, you know, to have a look at, see if it was all right? And she said, didn't matter whether it was made out of matchsticks, we were buying it.
And that was Hugh Wallace, architect, TV star and part-time psychologist, it would seem. Saturday's Reignite with Áine Kerr focused on family businesses and dynasties on the go for upwards of 200 years. And in one segment, Owen Sweeney looked at how some families were portrayed on the small screen, beginning with the brilliant Succession.
I've got to say, I feel a little bit used today, Pa. Where we are and all that's happened, and then even tonight you have to go off and work?
I made some calls. Jesus, can't you wait?
Can I wait for you to finish a few calls? Yeah, I think so. I think so, Pa. I've had a bit of practice.
Connor, your father has been busy dealing with these two traitors.
Disagreeing with Dad is not treason.
The best TV show ever made. I am prepared to argue this with anyone, anytime. Connor, Kendall, Roman and Shiv. Is there anyone likeable in this family business series, Owen Sweeney?
I don't know that there is.
Maybe Jerry.
Yeah, perhaps. But she has her own kind of nefarious goings on as well with one of the aforementioned. Anyway, without giving anything
away. No spoilers,
away,
yeah.
No spoilers. Very loosely based, obviously, on the Murdoch family and a media conglomerate. It's basically, isn't it? It's four children vying for their father's love, or indeed his billions. You know, this is the ultimate family business mix, isn't it? What happens when the patriarch steps down and you have four children who want to take over because, you know, they've known nothing other than riches. And basically, it's also kind of, I suppose, kind of sideways, kind of being declared the favourite, which at the end of the day... I don't know. I mean, would you go into business with all your family members? Would it be like Christmas dinner every day with all the resentments coming up? I don't know. It certainly is in Succession because, as I heard in that clip, Connor's personal feelings are never far from the surface.
Of course, no family TV drama discussion could take place without the 1980s cult classic Dallas.
I've been thinking of coming back to South Fork with John Ross, and you know how happy that'd make Mama.
Well, you always did think of other people's happiness.
Yeah, and as far as the company goes, we could team up again. I've got a whole floor that'd make a great office for you, Bobby. Now, just imagine, you and me running Daddy's company again.
You are truly amazing, JR. I have never given you enough credit.
Well, I hoped you'd like the idea.
What I like is the idea that we never work together again, ever.
I don't know whether it survived the test of time, Owen Sweeney. What's the verdict?
It ran for, 13 years? It's the dream of any producer. And as we all know, Series 9 was literally a dream inside Pamela's head. yeah, that's Bobby and J.R., of course, the warring brothers in Dallas. There are two businesses we might forget. There's the South Fork, you know, the home base, which was Miss Ellie, the mama there that you heard mentioned. That's her home place. That is the ranching and, of course, none more Texan. But none more 80s than Black Gold, which is, of course, Ewing Oil. So there's two businesses going on. There's the traditional kind of American homesteader approach and forging ahead. J.R., of course, got the reins. The father did step down, Jock Ewing, at the very start and handed it over to his eldest. Bobby was meant to be the star, but J.R.'s evil kind of persona and machinations became what people were preoccupied. And of course, he got shot. And who did it? Well, you know, you'll have to look it up, kids. but at the end of the day, the family resentments, the place in the family, and of course, Bobby and J.R. have completely different approaches to life. And basically, at the end of the day, Áine, they're both vying for their mum's affection.
Owen Sweeney there getting all Freudian on us. Now, summer may be over, but there was still time for Vincent Woods to get one last ice cream on the county measure, which this week saw him in Derry and meeting with Mr. Whippy.
How you doing?
Who could resist an ice cream here in this spot, in this lovely spot?
Especially downhill, beautiful beach, natural beauty.
What have you got? What have you got?
Strawberry, Nutella, chocolate, Milky Bar, butterscotch, bubble gum. For the bigger child in you, with some marshmallows, maybe.
Not hard to get that out.
That's the blues.
I'll go for the same.
The same simple old 99. Yeah. Hardly a bit old tradition. My name's Shane Carton, Mr. Whippy NI doorstep delivery and ice cream van in the North Coast. Family's been on it for 50 years. My father started it when I was 2 years of age. I'm 52 now, so it's all I've ever known.
It's great though.
First 99 I remember selling was 12p, and it was coming out of Station Road in Port Stewart in a CF Bedford van, and my mother was driving it. It's my proudest moment, I think, in life. But I always remember it, so.
Of course.
It's one of them ones that.
And Shane, did you grow up close to here?
Yeah, I grew up in Corian. And we used to travel from Corian down to Tralee Festival in County Kerry in an ice cream van. And it took us 2 days. We had to sleep in the van at night back in them days. And that's big enough for a child to sleep on, so. You didn't have a sleep in here room. And you were sleeping there, so. That was life.
Right.
It was life.
Yeah. It's a beautiful. It's my first time on this beach.
Oh, this.
Beautiful spot. Can you on a really clear day see Scotland?
Yeah. You would have seen it yesterday. Ah. Here was yesterday was crystal clear, beautiful, lovely and warm.
Shane, I think you have more customers.
Pleasure to meet you.
Have a nice day. Enjoy.
Also in Derry, Vincent met the amazing singer-songwriter Soak, who performed a piece called Teenage Dreams So Hard to Beat as a homage to her native city. Here's some of that performance.
When I was 17 or 18, a huge light festival came to Derry, and suddenly there was quotes lit up on tops of buildings and sculptures with beautiful glowing hearts in them. At the time, I think I was trying to find every reason I could to leave Derry. I think, like most people that age, I was ready to see something else. But I remember there was a sign just beside the Guildhall that said, "Teenage dreams so hard to beat." And I remember it really stopped me in my tracks and made me look around at where I was and admire the city. And now I'm 28. I can't get enough of Derry, to be honest. I go back at every opportunity. Like flames above the cold call centre, a sign screams, "Teenage dreams so hard to beat." Its brave, bright bulbs blink so big, they reach their arms to me. When we hold hands, the city glows, like asteroids burning blue overhead. I can see everything at once, my whole entire life, in Derry's wings full spread. I can see the first day I arrived, I made instant friends with Jack next door, because he had an inflatable Spider-Man, asthma, and his laugh would cut you to the core. I was 7, short and stubborn, but my imagination was good. They said I might never read or write, but I was determined I would. And it was outside that rusty reading centre where I met Mog in an old tire. Over the years we had Sumo, Cosmo, Daisy, Tootsie and Rocky sleeping by the fire, but we never named the stick insects, because, well, we couldn't tell them apart. That's where my ma drew the line, and she set them free in St. Colin's Park. I grew up lucky. Grew up with friends I couldn't tell you the things I have for. All our wonderful moronic adventures. All our comebacks and closer calls. They put batteries in my chest. Taught me morals and curse words. They were there for me no matter what time or day or month or cause. So I count down December from January 1st. When everyone's back together.
And that was Soak on The County Measure with Vincent Woods. Back shortly. Welcome back. This time last year, 20-year-old Ella Mills from Clontarf had fulfilled her lifelong dream and started studying at Columbia University in New York. Fully embracing life there, she joined numerous societies and clubs, including the Kayaking Society. Ella's father, Ralph, spoke to Claire Byrne and began by describing Ella.
She was unbelievably bright.
She was funny, sassy, determined, focused. I mean, you're asking her father here, so I could go on all day. But she was the first grandchild of a large extended family and our first child. And she was utterly adored by all. And then went to New York and set her up in her apartment. We said goodbye. Joanne couldn't turn away from the dorm room door as Ella went in. She had to watch her go to the lift, and she said, I can't turn my back. That was the last time we saw her.
So you went home, and it was just, was it just 2 weeks later?
3 weeks, 3 weeks. I think, yes. About 4 o'clock in the morning, Joanne gets a phone call from Clontarf Garda Station. We're going to send a couple of officers around. First asked, are you Ella Mills' mother?
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to send a couple of guards around who want to talk to you. You know, there was no doubt in our minds that we'd lost her.
Mm-hmm. And when the Gardaí came, is that what you were told at that point?
Yes, we had an appalling sort of probably only 10 minutes wait, but it sounded like a lifetime. And I ran out to meet the car, and they wouldn't say anything till we got in the house. And they were absolutely lovely. It devastated them to have to break the news.
It's a terrible thing for them to have to
do.
And that's the moment when your life changed.
Yes. And then we just sort of looked at each other and thought, right, we have to go upstairs and tell her siblings about this. We have to just knock the bottom out of their world.
The family would subsequently learn Ella went on a kayaking trip organised by a club in university, and she got into difficulty.
It wasn't a particularly good choice of river for novice kayakers. And they were going through some difficult rapids, and she came out of the boat and was pinned by an aquatic current, a sort of rolling current against the bottom of a rock. And the force of water is just incredible. I mean, tons and tons of water coming down at you. And the people present did what they could to rescue her. But having been and seen the scene, and I actually had a kayak with some of the people who tried to rescue her. And it quite clearly from that, it was an impossible situation. She fought. She was 2 minutes, they said, she was struggling.
In honour of Ella's memory and to raise charity funds, Ralph completed an aquamarathon, running a full marathon in a swimming pool.
I just needed to do something. I needed to commit to something and feel that there was some kind of positive coming out of it. Now, there's the fundraising for Kevin Bell, which, if it can help someone in our situation, then that would mean an awful lot. And for me personally, yes, the sort of metaphorical translation of the sort of one foot in front of the idea, in front of the other concept, an activity that would sort of physically bring me through the grief process in a way.
Did you feel Ella was with you at all?
Yeah, I don't want to be too sentimental about it, but yes, you do play sort of mind games when you're in that sort of situation, in that kind of challenge, and you're utterly exhausted, and it becomes purely mental. The pain is just blinding from your joints and your blisters and all that stuff. I like to imagine that she was actually running in front of me, because if someone does that through the water, you just wheeze along in their draft.
Yes.
It's easy. It's no effort at all. So I just like to picture Ella
in front of you,
parting the water for me.
Yeah.
Ralph Mills there, speaking to Claire Byrne. There's been much discussion this past week about dangers posed online for younger people. Australian Assistant Police Commissioner David McLean led an investigation into an online sexual predator, and he told Rachel English how the man came across his victims, which included an Irish person. Some of this material may not be suitable for younger ears.
A sexual predator who posed as a teenage YouTuber and blackmailed hundreds of girls and young women around the world, including an Irish child, has been jailed for 17 years in Western Australia. Mohammed Zain al-Abidine Rashid's victims were in 20 countries. Two-thirds of them were under the age of 16. The court heard that the 29-year-old pretended to be a 15-year-old YouTube star, then persistently blackmailed his victims to perform sex acts on camera.
He was quite prolific in his use of social media platforms and literally searched and trolled young victims, potential victims, individuals and groups, friendship groups, which had the didn't have their privacy settings adequately set, and that he was able to see the lists of friends. And so he would target individuals, migrate to their friends, generate conversations and connections to give the impression that he had relationships with friendship groups. The offender, as we know him today, was actually posing online as a high-profile young social media personality.
And can you give us a sense then of how he manipulated and how he blackmailed his victims?
Rachel, having made initial contact through a variety of different platforms, I should say, through a variety of different individuals and their friendship groups, using this profile, he simply gained their trust. The people identified with him quickly. He elicited conversations from them, and he would lure them into increasingly sordid and sexualized conversations. And once they had replied to some sometimes innocuous questions, and others more laced with sexual innuendo, he'd edit those chats and post them, or threaten to post them back to them. And having laid that trap, he would threaten to blackmail them.
Online safety expert Jim Gamble also spoke to Rachel and pointed out that parents could take the opportunity to talk about online engagement.
I've been involved in this since 2001, and once social media engaged around 2006 with Facebook, more and more young people began to occupy spaces where individuals who could pretend to be anyone they wanted could engage and talk to them. So it's not a new problem. This isn't a one-off. It's not rare. It's something that when we say to parents and carers, you need to talk to your children, this is something positive that parents and carers can use. Because how do you begin that conversation? Well, you begin it by saying, did you hear the news out of Australia? You actually say, I can't believe it. You know, do you think any of your friends could ever get caught up in that? It introduces it without being threatening, and then it allows you to do one of the most important things as a parent or carer you can do. Acknowledge, look, whenever I was young, I could see that I could have got trapped in things like this. I could have made mistakes. You do know that if you ever make a mistake, you can come to me. Anyone can be caught up in this, but the key is coming forward as soon as possible.
Staying online, over on Morning Ireland, a growing online trend where children as young as 7 adopt complex skincare routines was reported on by Kerry Doyle. She told Mary Wilson about her investigation for Primetime.
We are seeing as young as 7 using anti-aging and expensive skincare as part of a social media trend. And what's happening is they are seeing older influencers using lists of products on their faces, often exfoliating products, and they want to copy this from home. So we spoke to Sophie Deedy, who is 14 from Waterford, and she shared with us how she got into this trend.
When I was 12, I was on TikTok and I was seeing influencers put stuff on their skin, and I thought it was a good idea to go buy products. And then that kind of got me into it, and then I put it on my skin and then I was breaking out.
It's worth repeating again, Kerry. We're talking about children as young as 7 here in some cases.
Well, we're seeing brands collaborate with children's movies. We are seeing bright neon colours and cartoons on their bottles. We saw a report from Grandview Research last year predicted the children's personal care market globally will grow by more than 6% between now and 2030. So it's definitely a growing market.
And amid increasing calls for bans or limits on access to social media amongst teenagers, on Drive Time, the Irish Second Level Students Union said they wouldn't support such a ban. Jack McGinn joined Cormac.
We understand that there is issues that surround mobile phones and social media in school, but I suppose what we're saying is we need to educate and not restrict these students. We do believe that just banning mobile phones in secondary school, it really just pushes the problems that we associate with mobile phones past the end of the school day until 4 o'clock. We should really be focusing on actually equipping students how to decipher and avoids this harmful content online. Many new Leaving Cert courses now have projects which form a part of your final grade. And again, when schools don't have that adequate IT infrastructure, oftentimes mobile phones fill that gap.
Are you saying students are doing schoolwork on the phone?
Yes, Cormac, it happens throughout second level schools in the country.
Well, I can tell you, Jack, if when I was in school and if I had access to a phone, I'll tell you what I'd be doing. I wouldn't be doing schoolwork. I'd be checking the latest sports news or I'm not so sure. Maybe a good old pound Louis and a page and a book would do students no harm at all.
Good man, Cormac. Let's bring back chalk and blackboard, sure, while we're at it. This week, Donal Dineen has been filling in for Bernard Clark on Lyric FM. On Monday, Donal paid tribute to his friend Owen French, who went by the stage name Talos, and who tragically passed away this month.
Ultimately, we are each other, and our afterlife legacy is made of the impressions we make on the people surrounding us while we're in the land of the living. Whether that be through the way we conduct ourselves, the art or work we produce, our humanity in general. In Owen French's case, the effort he made throughout his 36 years on this earth was considerable on all those fronts, and then some. He wasn't just a brilliant lyricist and musician, but he was the complete artist, with a commitment to his craft that was unwavering and total. Knowing what he would have done is painful for all of us who were lucky enough to know him, given the extent of his talent and the shortness of his innings. But there's consolation too in the realization that a phenomenal body of work remains. And unlike our mortal bodies, this art of ours, and therefore his, will live forever. I'm absolutely certain that the name Talos will have a permanent place in that musical eternity. And the words of Owen French will live forever. All the songs are dedicated to Owen tonight. In fact, all the music from now on is in his honour, and that of all the other valiant soldiers who have fallen on the field, but not before, shedding blood, sweat and tears on our behalf in the name of endless art.
And that was Donal Dineen on Lyric, paying a heartfelt tribute to Owen French, known as Talos. I leave you now with the very beautiful In Time. Till next week.
Set a fire to the moonshade. We are just shadows in the cascades of history.